From Michigan Radio, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why are insurance companies asking to charge people more for medical insurance after 2 years of the Affordable Care Act?
And so they're really trying to say, now we have a little more data, we know who we're covering, people are using more health care than we expected, and so the rates are going up higher than they were previously.
Mapping out the future of rail travel in Michigan.
A lot of the rest of the world is quite jealous of how efficiently we can move our freight by rail, while you can't really say the same thing for our passenger network.
Growing interest in heritage plants means it's time for a Spartan comeback of Spartan barley.
Out in the field, we will rub shoulders with farmers that maybe not them grew the Spartan barley, but their grandfather did.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up.
These are incredibly challenging times for the Arab American community, and they're really feeling the impact. So I think our work right now is even more critical than it's ever been.
We'll speak with the director of the only Arab American museum in the nation. But first, the insurance companies offering health plans on Michigan's ACA exchange have a collective eye fixed on January 1st, 2017. That's the date when they hope they'll be able to start charging more for health insurance, nearly 17% more on average. Let's find out what's behind these hefty rate increase requests. Marianne Udall-Phillips is here with us. She's the director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Marianne, let's start real basic. These are the insurance companies that offer health insurance that complies with the Affordable Care Act, and we're talking about individual insurance?
That's right. These are mostly people who are buying the coverage themselves to cover themselves. Most of them get their coverage in Michigan through healthcare.gov, through the federal insurance exchange, but some people go directly to the insurance companies as well.
So in would small group coverage, is that affected by this request for higher rates?
Right. So these rates also went in for small groups, but very few people in Michigan and really nationally are getting their small group coverage through the health insurance exchange or through the Affordable Care Act.
So if you buy individual coverage, Marianne, whether it's on the exchange or on your own, we're talking to you. And as we speak about how many Michiganders are we talking about?
Well, there's actually 473,000 people total in the individual market in Michigan. And as of March in this year, 313,000 of them bought their coverage through the health insurance exchange.
So the big question, what kinds of increases are the companies talking about?
Well, what we've seen in the state is for all the issuers, for all areas of the state, an average request hasn't totally been approved yet, but an average request of 17.2% increase in the individual market. Now, that varies quite considerably based upon which health insurer, which health plan, and which geography you're located in, because there are still something like 199 different plans that are being offered, so people can get a range of different options out there. If we actually look at what people bought last year, Michigan's expected to see a rate increase of around 10%.
Marianne, more than 80% of the people who buy coverage on the exchange qualify for tax credit subsidies. Now, how would that work?
So most people won't actually see the premiums themselves and will have to pay the premiums themselves in total that are being offered by the insurers. More than 80% of Michigan's population got a tax credit last year to help them afford the health insurance coverage. So really, when you see very large rate increases, it means there's a big increase in the cost to the federal government because they're subsidizing the coverage for most people in our state.
But that means us.
That means the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. But for the first several years of the Affordable Care Act, those rates came in much lower than what the federal government predicted. So we're still sort of ahead of the game.
Well, I guess the question that every consumer is asking of us to answer right now is why?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why rates are going up now higher than they've gone up over the past couple of years. First of all, when the market first started, insurers had no information about who it was they were going to be covering. And they made a lot of guesses. The market was very competitive. They wanted to attract customers. They particularly wanted to attract the younger, healthier customers. And so some of them made guesses that were a little bit lower than what they actually experienced. They've now had a couple of years of experience with the population. Many people who came in on the exchange had not been insured before, and they had a big backlog in medical medical care needs. And so people have been using health care at higher rates than the insurers actually expected. And so they're really trying to say, now we have a little more data. We know who we're covering. People are using more health care than we expected. And so the rates are going up higher than they were previously. The other reason is, for the first couple of years the Affordable Care Act was in effect, the federal government provided some special programs to stabilize rates. Those programs are now expiring. So there was a program for risk to adjust the rates between health plans. There was a program for reinsurance to protect insurers against some unexpected higher costs. And those were really intended to ease people into the Affordable Care Act, ease the health plans into the Affordable Care Act. Those are now expiring. And so the health plans now have a little more information and are setting more rates that are reflective of the total cost that people are experiencing.
What about pharmaceutical cost? Is that factoring into this?
Pharmaceutical costs are the fastest growing part of healthcare. That's true for everybody, whether you have individual coverage or whether you have coverage through your employer, particularly specialty drugs. And that is a significant issue, but it's been an issue for a couple of years. It's not just this year going into 2017.
I know that there are people out there hearing this and hearing talk of rate increases who are going to feel this is profiteering.
Yes, it's really not profiteering. The insurance regulators in every state have to look very closely at what the insurance plans are proposing. They have to make sure those rates are justified. They have to be what's called actuarially sound. The insurers have to provide the data to the insurance regulators to tell them why the rates are going up. And the insurance regulators have their own actuaries who validate that that data is correct. Actually, most regulators are more worried about health plans going out of business because they underprice than they are about seeing overpricing. So we've seen some health plans in Michigan, for example, the co-op health plan couldn't stay in business. And regulators want to make sure that the health plans are stable. So they want to make sure they have enough funding in there for the people that they're covering. But also the Affordable Care Act regulates profits. And so the health plans are very limited, really, in what they can keep as profits under this law.
In fact, that's what I was wanting to get a sense of, if the ACA is a success in terms of profits or not for insurance companies.
Well, that's an interesting question because we've seen a number of insurance companies who say, you know, we're losing money on the individual market. So you had United Healthcare, for example, leave a number of markets. Wasn't very big in Michigan, but it left a number of markets in other states because they said they couldn't make money on the individual health market. Anthem, which is a very large Blue Cross plan in many other states, is just announced that they've been losing money on the individual market, and they're very big in this market. Blue Cross of Michigan says that they've had some challenges in this individual market. So overall, health plans are doing pretty well.
Some are doing really well, aren't
they? Some are doing very well, and we've seen that in the most recent rate reports in Michigan, particularly with the managed care organizations, the health maintenance organizations. They seem to be doing overall extremely well. But this particular market, this individual market, is always the market that's the most challenged and difficult for insurers to manage.
I still get the sense that there are people inside their head saying, oh, well, here we go. They got us signed up under the ACA. We pay a penalty if we don't have health insurance. So, okay, we've got them. Let's hike the rates.
There are controls in the Affordable Care Act to stop that from happening. The insurers are limited to only 15% that they can take for administrative cost and profits. The regulators are supposed to be overseeing it. And any rate increase that's higher than 10% gets special scrutiny. Again, many of these are rates that have been requested. We heard much higher numbers earlier this year were going to be requested, so they've pared back. So, you know, the real reason that healthcare insurance is really high cost is because healthcare is high cost.
And is that the reason we heard that earlier news that 200,000 seniors are going to get smacked with a rate hike for their Medigap, and Blue Cross is going to move ahead with that rate increase? Is that tied into the same dynamics?
Well, the Medigap rate increase is a really specific situation in Michigan because those rates were intentionally frozen by the state for 5 years. So you had healthcare costs going up every year, but Blue Cross was not raising the rates to match what healthcare costs. And I have a very big backlog, right? It's grown over that time. So that's a little bit of a unique situation. But healthcare costs still are, even though they've moderated a lot in recent years, they're still outstripping general inflation and growth in the economy.
So you've touched, you kind of alluded to this, shopping around on the exchange can help depending on where you live.
That's right. If you live in the Detroit area or many urban areas, mm-hmm. especially in southeast Michigan, you'll have lots of choices of health plans on the exchange, and you can certainly mitigate those rate increases quite significantly. Unfortunately, if you live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you don't have many choices. Rates went up there last year quite high. And so you're going to have just many fewer options.
State regulators are the ones who will ultimately say yes or no to these rate increase requests. And we know that the Department of Insurance and Financial Services has opened its period inviting public comment. How can people weigh in on this, Marianne?
People can send notes and emails and letters to the department and certainly give them, as you said, they're open for that feedback.
And then what happens? Because I know this all has to be nailed down by November 1st, doesn't it? Because that's
right.
when the exchange opens up for new customers.
That's right. That's right. So they'll take all those comments. Because we're a federally regulated state, the federal government will also look at those rates based upon the recommendations of the state, and then they'll be published this fall shortly before the final rates will be published this fall shortly before the exchange opens for enrollment.
Marianne Udall Phillips, the director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Marianne, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
And it's great to be here, Cindy. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More and more of us are getting on board the local food movement and seeking out heritage or heirloom plants. So it's a perfect time to revive Spartan barley, developed a century ago by a professor at Michigan State University. Ashley McFarland is the coordinator of MSU's Upper Peninsula Research and Extension Center. Ashley, just what is Spartan barley?
Spartan barley is essentially just a variety of barley. So with any agronomic crop, you've got different varieties that have different traits that make them useful. And so Spartan was just one of those varieties that was bred a long time ago, actually 100 years ago. It became useful not only in Michigan, but in other states for the purpose of brewing. So malting barley is a crop that's intended then to be processed or malted that then can be used into beer. So it was a variety that was created just simply for that purpose way back in 1916, although it was released in the 20s is when it actually became available for farmers to grow. At one time, a third of the Nebraska malting barley crop was actually in Spartan barley, which is really kind of interesting. So it found popularity not only in Michigan, but other states throughout the Midwest.
And when was its heyday?
Probably in like the 30s, 40s, 50s. It had about a 30-year stronghold. And then just like every other crop, new things are bred, new varieties are created, and looking at things like yield and different quality factors that become important according to the market. You know, just breeding over time changes, and so does the genetics and what folks are interested in. So, yeah, so it did have about a 30-year run and then pretty much went to sleep until we brought it back last year.
I love the way you said went to sleep. So what got you thinking, hey, let's wake up Spartan barley, bring it back?
We've been doing malting barley research now in Michigan for a few years, and in our travels throughout the state, it's interesting because there is quite a historical, you know, premise for not only growing malting barley, but malting within the state, especially for the Stroh Brewery that once resided within Michigan. Out in the field, we will rub shoulders with farmers that maybe not them grew the Spartan barley, but their grandfather did. I remember when we used to have Spartan barley on our farm. So just a lot of this conversation came about, and it's interesting, you know, people really get excited about that Spartan brand. And so we thought, well, hey, why not try to revive it? Really, it's the only well-known malting barley variety that Michigan State ever released. There's uniqueness in that as well. And of course, with the Spartan name, you can't go wrong.
A section of Michigan. Now, there might be some other Wolverine fans who may disagree with that.
That's true, but we bleed green here, so.
Now, I found it fascinating when you decided to bring back Spartan barley that you turned to something, I guarantee you, most of the rest of the civilian world didn't even know this existed, the government germplasm bank?
Yes, way out west in the mountains. There lies this probably very dusty old building with thousands upon thousands of varieties of different varieties. varieties of seeds and different crops. And they do that just to basically be able to hold on to the genetic material because someday it may be useful. Dr. Russell Fried at Michigan State University, who's worked on barley for a long time throughout his career, had contacts out there and reached out to them and just said, hey, by chance, do you've got some Spartan on your hands? And they did and sent us a very, very small amount. I think it was like 5 grams for Russ to actually grow in the greenhouse. And so he grew some plants in the greenhouse, harvested those by hand, gave us seed last year, and we were able to grow our first test plot, you could say. Really, we're just trying to increase seed because to do research, you need a greater volume of seed to do that. Currently, we've got about 10 acres of it down at the W.K. Kellogg Biological Station. We do have a small plot up here in the Upper Peninsula as well, but wanted to keep it downstate because that's where most of the malt house capabilities are at this moment. So we want to make sure it's close to its market.
So it takes some coaxing and love and care to take that 5-gram sample that you've got from the government germplasm bank and be able to actually have enough Spartan barley to give to farmers to grow than to give them to the maltsters.
Most definitely. Granted, a lot of the work that we do is very small in scale compared to the large commercial, you know, malt houses of out west, even in the upper Great Lakes region. We work primarily with what we call craft maltsters and then ultimately craft brewers, people that are doing, you know, a little bit smaller batch sizes. But still, it takes a volume. It takes a grander amount to actually get this into the marketplace. And we're still trying to figure out ourselves if it's a suitable crop. I mean, obviously, you know, 50 some, if not more years ago, it kind of lost favor by farmers, and it did probably for a reason. And so we're just trying to bring it back to see if it's really viable, if farmers can be productive with it. You know, what's the demand for it? And we do get a lot of phone calls, a lot of farmers, especially people with Spartan degrees or people that have paid lots of money into MSU. They want a piece of it. They have interest in it. We haven't handed out seed to anyone yet. We just want to make sure it's good before we start passing it out. But I do think there will be opportunity for farmers to possibly get their hands on it next year.
Well, when I think about it, Ashley, the rise in craft brewing and microbrewing in Michigan seems to be a good time as opposed to the great big mass brewers.
There's a place in the market for all beer. However, Michigan really has on its hat on this idea of craft. And not only the ones that we all think of, Bell's, Founders, Shorts, all of them throughout Michigan, but we've got a lot of small pub breweries, people that do small batches. They really have the opportunity to market this product specific, like this is a Spartan beer, you know, and be able to recoup, you know, the expense that goes along with sourcing local. Because with this, you know, industry being fairly new and the scale being quite small, there is a bit of a premium to utilize Michigan-grown and Michigan-malted malt. The market is really asking for it. Michigan is no better place. I mean, we know we can grow the barley. We know we have a demand for it.
Ashley McFarland is the coordinator of Michigan State University's Upper Peninsula Research and Extension Center, waking up Spartan barley and bringing it back to farmers and maltsters 100 years after it was first made. Really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Certainly, and thank you for having me.
A presidential candidate who talks of banning Muslim immigrants, controversy about receiving Syrian refugees, the fallout after 9/11. You don't have to look too far to find suspicion and misunderstanding aimed at Arab Americans, which is why the Arab American National Museum knows it has a very important job to do. The Dearborn Museum opened in 2005, and it's been so successful in sharing the story of Arab Americans that it's been chosen to be an affiliate of the Smithsonian. And it's a rare museum that can make that claim. Devin Ackman is executive director of the Arab American National Museum. Good to have you here, Devin.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk about that honor from the Smithsonian. I saw your face light up as I mentioned it. What did that mean to you as part of the museum to have that honor of being named an affiliate of the Smithsonian?
Well, it was incredibly important. We got that designation within the first 2 years of being in operation. So to take a step back, we're the first and only museum of its kind in the nation, 22,000 plus museums, and the Arab American National Museum is the only one telling the Arab American story. So not having a similar institution to compare ourselves to and striving to build support from Arab Americans across the nation, getting a designation like that so early on essentially helped to legitimize the museum in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of Arab Americans across this nation. So that was really the first major designation bestowed upon our institution. And since that time, over the last now 11 years that we've been in operation, it's been incredibly fruitful. We have continued partnerships ongoing with the Smithsonian, whether they're public programs, collection initiatives, curatorial initiatives. So it's truly a way in which our museum and the Smithsonian can collaborate and share resources.
When you think about the fact that, as you say, it's been 11 years since the doors first opened, how do you personally measure and rate the success of the museum?
Well, that can be measured in many ways. For us, the first 5 years, so to speak, were really about building the capacity and infrastructure of an institution, a new museum. Since that time, it's really about expanding our footprint across the country and truly living up to the national designation that's in our title. So that's about taking exhibitions on the road, galvanizing our community around the country to support the institution, new collaborations, new initiatives. And I think we've managed to do a fairly good job of doing that in the first 11 years. And we've really set our sights high for the next 10 years. We just unveiled a new strategic plan in the last couple of years, and it's really about increasing our national imprint.
What about attendance, particularly attendance from people who are not Arab, which I suspect when somebody comes in and you realize that, that's an aha moment.
Yeah, well, that's a really important thing to impress upon. So our on-site attendance is about 55,000 people annually. We're considered a mid-sized museum, and of that, about half of our audience is school children. And in terms of ethnicity, we do get a lot of Arab Americans, as you might imagine, but even more so, we have a lot of folks who are non-Arab. And that's incredibly important in terms of building community, greater understanding. Now, the vast majority of our attendance is actually off-site. Most people don't realize that.
You call yourself a museum without walls.
Yes, we do. We have so many initiatives really taking place across the region and across the nation. So we just got done presenting the annual Concert of Colors in Detroit in collaboration with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, the DIA, the Charles Wright Museum. And there was only one small program at our museum that happened all in Midtown Detroit. We have the pleasure of partnering with the Michigan Theater here in Ann Arbor on Cinetopia. And then nationally, we have exhibitions that are really traveling to institutions from East Coast to West Coast. We have an exhibit going to Ellis Island Immigration Museum later this year. So approximately 150 to 250,000 people attend our stuff annually offsite. So as you can see, the bulk of our visitors or our patrons are actually outside of the museum.
What about in Southeast Michigan, really on the ground level? How have you seen the museum affect relations between Arabs and non-Arabs, especially in Southeast Michigan?
Well, what's really wonderful is we're part of this larger nonprofit called Access, which has now been in existence for 45 years. And through Access's work, there have been so many organic collaborations with non-Arab American communities over the years. And the Arab American National Museum is essentially an extension of that. So we have such a deep history in this region, working with other communities and even having a presence. I mean, so many people think of Arab Americans as really being a more recent group in this nation. But we've been here for well over 100 years. In fact, my family came to the U.S. over 100 years ago. So we've had a presence in the region. And like so many others, we came here originally for the auto industry, and our community has grown and grown and grown. So I think there is a level of familiarity with people in Southeast Michigan with our community. And that's just allowed us to have a lot of organic relationships and a lot of, you know, just comfort in the presence of our community.
I know you're telling the story of Arab Americans, and how challenging is it to have one museum that can do justice to the 22 countries of the Arab world, not all of whom are friendly with each other?
Well, that's a really important point because we are not a monolithic group. We are incredibly diverse. We come from 22 different countries. Our presence in America has spanned a great deal of time, so our experience in this nation is different. We're religiously diverse. I mean, there's so much diversity within a community. So we are very cognizant of how we approach our work. When it comes to exhibitions, we have used a very interesting interpretive tool. What we try to do is tell individual vignettes that make up the larger Arab American story. And in doing so, what you're really getting is a mosaic of our culture. And you're also having the opportunity for individuals to connect on a one-to-one basis with an individual story. So you begin to say, well, that story is very similar to mine. Well, of course, this is also an American story. And through that process, we get to really make connections. And of course, we do numerous public programs over the course of the year. And through those, we can really feature different aspects of our community and bring that to light.
I guess kind of taking that idea of, hey, we went through that as well in our family. Let's talk about why the work you do is so important right now in this climate.
Well, a lot of people often ask, you know, how this compares with the experience after 9/11. And that was a very challenging time for our community. But there were definitely a lot of silver linings in that experience. Institutions like the Arab American National Museum were created. However, right now, there is a huge challenge. We're living in what I feel like is a more xenophobic time. There is this rise of what we're calling Islamophobia. And, you know, the political rhetoric, so much is happening right now. So it's a lot more challenging. And then, of course, what we're seeing overseas, there's a lot of conflict, a lot of strife, a lot of displacement. So
it's a lot of bloodshed.
A lot of bloodshed. So these are incredibly challenging times for the Arab American community, and they're really feeling the impact. So I think our work right now is even more critical than it's ever been. And we're really doing our best to be responsive to our community through exhibitions and public programs. So, for example, right now we have an exhibition called What We Carried that is looking at the experiences of Iraqi and Syrian refugees across the nation. It's not just in Metro Detroit. This is a photographic exhibit. And our hope is that through presenting this work, people will see a more humanizing aspect or make this more humanizing aspect of our community's experience.
And I've got to imagine every time there's some headline from overseas, and like we've just had a spate of awful stories, Nice. And how do you personally think, all right, we've got to turn down the fear. We've got to turn down that xenophobia. What can I do?
Well, what we continuously try to do is just tell an accurate depiction of our community. And it's very easy for greater stereotypes and misconceptions to kind of come out of these incidents. So for us, it's really just about continuing to really drill down on who we are, what we are, and to reclaim our story and to make sure our story is being told from our perspective. That's why our museum is so critical.
Own your story.
Yes.
Where do you want to see the Arab American National Museum go in its next decade?
Well, there's a lot of transformation taking place in Southeast Michigan and Metro Detroit. And as a cultural institution, we see a role in that evolution. So we're looking at a regional transit plan that's taking place in Southeast Michigan. What is our role in helping our community and being part of that development? So we're looking at placemaking, we're looking at the changes in Southeast Michigan, and we're asking ourselves, how do we play a role in that as a cultural institution? And for us, it's really about putting the Arab American story in context with the greater American narrative. And that's why it's so critical for us to travel our exhibitions, to place our public programs and other major institutions where a predominantly non-Arab audience will have an opportunity to interact and see that. So it's really just continuing to expand our national footprint.
The Arab American National Museum is right there on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn in Wayne County, and you can learn more by going to arabamericanmuseum.org. Devin Ackman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does outdoor Michigan mean to you? For decades, hunting and fishing would likely have been among the top answers. But times change, and now those answers could be mountain biking, kayaking, kiteboarding. And that means Michigan needs to retool the way it's pitching its outdoor charms. Ted Roloffs looks at selling Michigan to a new outdoors generation in his latest piece for Bridge Magazine. Good to have you on the program, Ted.
Good to be with you.
Let's start right out with hunting and fishing, a big, big source of money for state conservation efforts with license fees, no?
Oh, absolutely. That's kind of the heart of what supports a variety of conservation efforts across the state.
And what do the numbers tell us about hunting and fishing being on the decline in Michigan?
It seems to be a generational thing. We looked at some numbers for both hunting and fishing and went all the way back to 85 with fishing licenses and found that from 85 to 2015, it's down by one-third, which is pretty significant. Hunting was down about 10% from 09 to 2015. And I think what's happening is it's a generational shift where the older anglers, hunters, more interested in this as an activity. And as you get younger and younger, I think you're getting fewer participants. It's just generations have different tastes in what they like to do. So not so much interest in hunting and fishing, more interest in other activities, from kiteboarding to stand-up paddleboarding to mountain biking. And that's kind of what we looked at, different communities around Michigan and what they're doing to capitalize on the assets they have and the shifts in recreational interests.
Give us some of the success stories you found, Ted, that shows how you can repackage outdoor Michigan for that generation that doesn't want to hunt and fish.
Yeah, I led off with a city that I didn't know this at all about, Alpena. They have a incredible nationally designated marine sanctuary offshore where there's more than 100 shipwrecks from near shore to well out into the lake. But the establishment of that sanctuary and then a museum that came after it, that museum alone is bringing about 90,000 visitors a year to a city of 10,000. And you've got a lot of people coming there to, there's divers, there's kayakers who go offshore. You can see a lot of these wrecks very close to shore. So it's just brought a real influx of people, not just from Michigan, but from around the country. It's a unique resource. So that was one example. Looked at Marquette, and they're really aggressively promoting the asset they have, which is an incredible network of trails, largely mountain biking, but cross-country skiing, that sort of thing, trail running. And, you know, they're now getting visibility in national publications as a destination place for mountain biking.
And so that pulls people in from all over.
Yeah, I talked to a woman who's part of the recreation promoter for the Convention Bureau in that area, and she just casually mentioned, oh, we have a group from Chicago coming up for the 4th of July weekend. There's about 60 of them coming up. And when you think about that, again, this is not a large city, but you got 60 people coming up for several days. They're going to be spending a lot of money.
I have also talked to people who are involved up in the Leelanau area and also up around Marquette with surfing, which, you know, one doesn't think of that with Michigan, but there's a pretty thriving little surfing scene going on.
Absolutely. In fact, when I started looking into whether it's Marquette, and I also looked at the city of Duluth, they have year-round surfing scenes, which is kind of surprising. But apparently there's some conditions around wintertime that are really good for surfing. So you got these hardcore people putting on the wetsuits, going out there and waiting for the good waves, and it doesn't matter what the temperature is.
And then Grand Rapids, and I know I have talked to officials in Grand Rapids about this whole plan, and it's a big one, isn't it, to restore rapids to the Grand River?
Yeah, it's big, it's expensive, it's complex, and if it's going to happen, it's going to be some years. There's a federal permitting process that they have to go through to get approval, and then they have to find a way to fund it, which is would be the next big step. But the ultimate goal is to convert a mile or so of river right through the heart of Grand Rapids back to its original state of rapids. And the hope there is to draw all sorts of people that want to use that, kayakers, et cetera, as a destination. And they've had an economic impact study that I think estimated something on the order of $15 million or so in annual economic impact should this happen. But I think that's just another classic example of cities kind of reimagining themselves and looking at, well, what assets do we have? Well, how about this river running right through the heart of the city and the river that really, in a lot of ways, gave birth to the establishment of this community? But here's a new way we can use it.
And that really strikes me. That's the takeaway of what you're saying to communities and to the state is you know, don't rely on the way we've always done it, because those hunters aren't coming in the way that they used to.
Yeah. I think really ultimately what you're looking for is economic development in terms of people coming to your community. They're going to spend money. That has impact. But also making your community a place that people, and especially young people, young professionals, want to live. And the more you can develop these different forms of outdoor activities, the more likely it is you're going to attract a certain subset of person that's really drawn to those things.
Ted Roloffs. His story is headlined as Hunting Wanes, Selling Michigan to a New Outdoors Generation. You'll find it at bridgemi.com. Always great to talk with you, Ted. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was fun.
The spotlight in Marquette will soon be fixed on trains. The Michigan Rail Conference happens at Northern Michigan University August 17th and 18th. It gives us a chance to check up on how things are faring for passenger and freight trains in Michigan. Here with us is Pasi Lautula, who's an assistant professor at Michigan Tech, where he directs the Rail Trans program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is the fourth annual Michigan Rail Conference, so it's clearly working. It's being done again and again. What is the goal, and to whom is it aimed?
The goal is to just increase the awareness of rail transportation and the importance of the rail transportation, honestly, for everybody in the state of Michigan. And we try to take a pretty broad brush when it comes to aiming the conference. We try to be very versatile with our speakers and with our topics, so it attracts quite a range of folks from actual professionals working in the railway industry, like the employees from the railroad companies,
to state agencies like Michigan Department of Transportation, some academics, but we also get a lot of people who are just simply a train enthusiasts or work in the very important group, which is all the kind of advisory groups or volunteer groups like Michigan Association of Railroad Passengers. So we get quite a range of people to the conference, and we like it.
I know you're going to kind of open things off as being part of a panel on preserving, maintaining, and enhancing Michigan rail assets. If you were to assign a grade to Michigan's existing rail assets, what would it be?
Ooh, I got to be really careful when it comes to the grading, as I'm sure there is a lot of different opinions on where the grade is. I think there is also a lot of difference on whether we talk about some of the assets that are concentrating on the passenger side versus the freight side.
Fair enough. Well, let's start with passenger rail. How vibrant do you feel the passenger rail system is in Michigan?
We have the Michigan Accelerated Rail Corridor, and that's one of the most, I would say, most advanced intercity corridors that exist in the U.S. today, and there's a lot of activity going on that, improving the corridor and increasing the speed.
And I think for everybody, just to be on the same page, is that the one from Detroit to Chicago?
That is correct. So I think that's a corridor that a lot of people who are interested in passenger rail are looking very closely and seeing how Michigan is going to be succeeding in their goals with that corridor.
And what about, if we want to contrast that with what we have in freight rail in Michigan?
Well, the freight rail is, of course, always a little bit of a different ballgame because it's all private infrastructure. Well, actually, in Michigan, some of the lines are owned by the state of Michigan, but they are operated by the private companies. And there really is two sides of the story for that. We have the main lines operated by the larger freight railroads that are through lines for a lot of traffic from even from coast to coast and from Canada to U.S. And then we have the much lower grade network of the short line railroads that handle more the regional traffic. You know, there's certainly room for improvement on both sides, but I think especially challenging is always to keep this regional network up to good shape and good condition, as the volumes are not as significant as they are in the nationwide network.
What's more important in your view for Michigan, freight or passenger?
I think that's fairly misleading to say that one is more important than the other one. I really believe that rail transportation should be a part of a balanced transportation system nationwide, whether it's a passenger transportation or the freight transportation. Now, if we look at the USA, not only Michigan, but the whole USA, our freight network is really quite extensive and quite excellent. A lot of the rest of the world is quite jealous of how efficiently we can move our freight by rail. While you can't really say the same thing for our passenger network, I mean, anybody who's traveled in Europe or some Asian countries know that the trains are much faster there, the quality is excellent, and the frequencies are really tight. So, you know, if you look at the global scale, we certainly have much more room for increasing and improvement on the passenger side than on the freight. But they both are, in my opinion, extremely important.
Let's talk about Michigan policy. What do you see as the opportunities and the challenges that rail faces, first in bolstering the economy of the Upper Peninsula?
Well, yeah, the Upper Peninsula is obviously, we are almost like the little brother of the rest of the state of Michigan. For us, the biggest challenge probably for rail transportation, obviously all of our rail transportation here is freight, at least at the moment. And I have a hard time to believe that we could get passengers here anytime soon, as you really need passenger volumes for passenger transportation. But for freight transportation, the big challenge is that we are fairly large geographic region, but at the same time, we don't have very large manufacturing or other natural resource or industrial hubs. So we have large rail network in the Upper Peninsula, while our volumes are not concentrated on certain locations and are not very large when it comes to the railroad tonnages. So the real challenge is to maintain the network and make sure that we still keep shipping by rail, but are able to do that so that it's still competitive. Because if you can't make it financially or economically viable, then it's hard for private companies to justify providing the service.
And what about the Lower Peninsula? The same question. Different opportunities and challenges for the Lower Peninsula?
I think the Lower Peninsula, and I can't claim that I'm the utmost expert on everything in Lower Peninsula, but Lower Peninsula certainly has some of the same challenges than we do, especially kind of for the northern parts of the Lower Peninsula. The lower part of Lower Peninsula, the kind of Detroit and the metropolitan areas, I think in those areas, it's a little bit more on the freight certainly exists there, and there's plenty of freight. It's more of a how do we keep moving this as efficiently as possible, and how do we keep on integrating it better with our other freight transportation modes like water transportation and trucks especially.
I'm interested just knowing that there you are, you direct the rail trans program at Michigan Tech and a keen observer of Michigan's rail transportation system. I'm interested in your thoughts on the M1 rail, which, as we all know, is the private-public partnership building that 3.3-mile track for a streetcar that'll loop from downtown Detroit to Midtown and back. And we hear its backers promising the M1 will be a catalyst for all kinds of good things, economic development and investment dollars and urban renewal. At the same time, you hear people openly ask, how much difference can a 3-mile loop really make? And wouldn't all that money be better spent shoring up, let's say, the bus system to help more people get to work and to school? What are your thoughts?
Well, one thing that history has shown us is that it is extremely difficult to forecast what are the impacts of these kind of systems. But one thing that is really exciting about that system is the fact there is a heavy private funding and backing for the system, and we really haven't seen that in the rest of the country before. So I think everybody's eyes in some ways are on the M1 rail system to see that, does it really deliver what these private investors and also public investors are expecting it to deliver? I don't want to be the one making the forecast. I think we maybe sometimes spend a little bit too much time trying to make the forecast, since the market conditions and the economic times and all these things tend to change and affect the forecast. So I'm excited about the project. I'm excited that they are actually getting it up, completed, and running. And I can't wait to see what are the real effects. I mean, as much as I know, I think the results have been pretty promising so far for when it comes to the real estate along the corridor and so on.
I know you're from Finland, and you did mention that America's freight rail system is the envy of many around the world. And then you flip the coin and passenger rail travel in Europe. You know, we're so far behind where that is here in this country. Do you ever see a day truly when you think passenger rail travel in this country would be on par with Europe's?
Well, if that day comes, it's definitely going to be really far away in the future. I mean, one thing we have to remember, for example, when it comes to the high-speed rail networks, is that Europe, for example, has been investing on that network heavily, probably for almost half a decade by now. And that's an annual investment that continues and keeps going. When you start from way behind, it is not easy to build up to that level of system that we see in the Europe. And to be honest, I don't think we should have that level of system everywhere in the U.S. We are a very different country when it comes to our extensiveness of the country and large size of it and how far our big metropolitan areas are from each other. So I don't think a similar kind of almost like a, I guess in Europe you could say that it's a content-wide system, but in U.S. you could say nationwide system. I don't think it really makes sense to try to build that kind of passenger nationwide system. What I think we should concentrate more in is looking at these pockets like Midwest, Northeast, California, and try to build good rail transportation in those places where it really is needed and where really it really could be successful. So if we can concentrate more on the regional thinking, there's a better chance of making some serious progress on the topic.
And it does really come down to mindset, doesn't it? Because in Europe, you don't think twice. You know, your parents took the train, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. So Europeans don't think twice. Here it's different. And I'm wondering, how do you and others who are involved in studying and advising and implementing Michigan's rail system make converts to support rail? I guess, in other words, I'm asking, how do you get people who can't or won't think beyond their cars to care about trains in Michigan?
Well, if you can solve that puzzle, then let me know, because I think that would be an excellent thing to figure out. But I think you have to prove through success in some ways. When you can start having a system components, which could be one rail line like the Michigan Accelerated Rail Corridor, when you can show success in those lines where your trains are moving at the right speed so that it's competitive, where they are moving reliably, so there's no delays. That's the one thing that is probably even more important than the speed, and where there is a sufficient level of service so that people can actually make their plans and not worry about, do I miss my train because the next one goes 6 hours later. As soon as you can see that kind of success, it automatically or naturally starts feeding to other people and get other folks interested and attracted on this aspect. And I mean, I think there's a little bit of a generational difference too. I mean, people who are studying the new generation coming up, I believe there's less people who own driver's licenses, automobiles. There's more youth who really wants to use public transportation and don't necessarily want to always use their own car. And just one thing to mention about the Europe, I mean, they have excellent rail system, but it doesn't mean that they don't drive cars. They drive a lot of cars.
Yes.
And they move a lot by car. So it doesn't mean that even if we were to succeed with the rail system, it's not going to take away all the challenges with congestion and so on. We're still going to have enormous amount of vehicle traffic on the roads.
The Michigan Rail Conference will be August 17th and 18th at Northern Michigan University in Marquette. And we have been talking to Pasi Latola, who is an assistant professor at Michigan Tech, where he directs the Rail Trans program. It was great getting your insights, Pasi. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Daniel Razel, Kate Summers, and Carl Williams. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.